Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. My guest today is James Ashton, who, as a business journalist writing for The Telegraph, The Daily Mail, The Times, The Independent, The Scotsman, Business AM, The Financial Times, and Reuters, and as city editor of The Sunday Times and The Evening Standard, it is fair to say has spent a lifetime interviewing business leaders. I once read in a Harvard Business Review that describing leadership is similar to the challenge of describing a bowl. One can easily define it in terms of the clay from which it is made or the process of its manufacture and its total size. But no true picture can emerge until one includes the hollow, the negative space that defines the bowl's capacity. James Ashton's latest book, The Nine Types of Leader, How the Leaders of Tomorrow Can Learn from the Leaders of Today, attempts to do both, to describe both the clay leadership is made of, but more importantly, the space it creates for an organization to flourish. Welcome, James.
Alex, thank you. Thanks. It's great to be on.
Your attempt to categorize nine types of leader, alphas, fixers, sellers, founders, scions, lovers, campaigners, diplomats, and humans. It seems to me, reading the book, you could have easily made them four or five, with some being hybrids, or separated them into 15. Why were these nine the ones you landed on?
It's a good question. I think I should try and answer this through using the medium of clay and enamel, because it's a wonderful analogy you started with, and I did try to get to a little bit in the writing of it. What were the raw materials? How did these CEOs get there in the first place? So how did I get to nine? You're right. I mean, what is the right number? I started with a couple that I was really, really interested in, and one of the joys for me of going into interview a CEO for one of these weekend profile slots is you have a good scour across their CV, first of all, and you see where they've been, where the gaps are, where the big decisions and the jumps might have come. I think there are some obvious ones in there that readers would be familiar with. So founders, and I think to some degree, you know, campaigners, the business leaders that are very good at profit plus purpose. And then I tacked on the ones that I thought were curious, and I've always been very interested in family-run businesses. So the scions, so what do you do if you inherit from your father or mother, and then to what degree do you stick close to that legacy? And fixers, I think, are very interesting, people that mend broken companies. I added on and added on, and I got to nine, and it felt about right. I suppose that's as scientific as it was.
Shall we look at a few examples then from politics and business, just to pair them off and maybe explore some of the categories? So I will give you Angela Merkel, Donald Trump, Rupert Murdoch, and Bill Gates.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump is the alpha. I think what's interesting about Trump is, I say through a lot of the chapters in this book, that what makes good modern leadership and forward-thinking leadership, particularly you see it in the humans chapter, I think it explains why these sellers have risen up through organizations so well. I think they're very, very good communicators. Now, you don't normally think of an alpha as a good communicator. They don't usually care what anybody thinks about them. But social media, you know, were his absolutely his tool, the tools of his trade. So it's quite interesting as to how he arranged his ascent, if you like. So I put him absolutely in the alpha category.
How about Angela Merkel?
What would I put her? I think you could put her in the diplomats category. I think she is firm but fair. I think she's quite consensual in how she operates, and I think she's quite humble with it, if you like. You know, I don't remember seeing any pictures of Donald Trump going down the shops for example, whereas Angela Merkel is much less concerned about the image. It's much more human than superhuman.
Now, how about Rupert Murdoch?
Well, it's interesting because he did inherit, of course. There's a question mark with some of these founders versus scions. At what point do you draw the line? He inherited a handful of newspapers from his father and clearly built a huge empire off the back of that. I think I would have to think of him as the founder. And the issue with the founder is you have great credibility, I think, in that you were the person sat at the metaphorical kitchen table to begin with. You grew this empire from nothing, from whatever your back of the envelope plan calculations that you had. I think the challenge for the founder is to know when to step back and to hand over.
Yes, we've seen it recently. Cling on.
Yes, and we've seen it recently with Jeff Bezos. You know, at what point is the right moment to hand over? And some do it very well, and some you might pick out. Stelios from EasyJet. It's a much more tortured handover if you can let go. And so with Rupert Murdoch, I mean, he must be loosening the strings by now because of his age, and arguably you can say that there was a degree of letting go when the businesses were demerged a few years ago into TV and satellite and to newspapers, and then a lot of that was sold off. So I think there's been a letting go there. Yeah.
And what about Bill Gates?
I mean, he is very, very easily the founder from memory, either the founder or the co-founder of Microsoft. I think what's interesting is what he's gone on to do with it. Obviously, the company, I think he's still a shareholder in the company, but he has long ago left the company behind. It sank a little and it's risen up now under Satya Nadella and this huge wall of money that's gone into tech companies, in particular in the last year when we've all been locked down. I think he's quite an efficient campaigner now. He's not quite working off that corporate platform and marrying profit with purpose, but he is undoubtedly, through the foundation, putting his money to good use.
I recently interviewed Dr. Pippa Malmgren, who has been a strategy advisor to everyone from UBS to President George W. Bush and has also written a book on leadership. And she suggests that the truly successful leader of the now is constantly fluid. It's a sort of balancing of styles, a management capoeira in perpetual movement. Is there such a thing as a chameleon leader? Have you come across someone who you thought he's aware of the different styles and borrows elements to suit the task?
I think leaders like to think they're very adaptable and very versatile. And it's true as their careers go on, they gain understanding of new markets, new industries, new technologies, and so on. I don't think the taxonomy of my book is something that a lot of business leaders would welcome because I don't think they like to be pigeonholed too much. I mean, there are examples. Mm. There are types, I think, that a lot of leaders will gravitate to, whether that's campaigner or the human. But on balance, I think a lot of them develop a playbook, whether they have real strengths in sales and marketing or fixing companies. And I think they repeat them over several times in their career. I think what's an interesting thing that you mentioned there and that Pippa talked about is the measure of success. I mean, you can argue that leadership has become a lot harder, companies have become a lot larger, and there are a lot of metrics by which you can measure success and failure. So, you know, small violin for the CEO who's paid £5 to £10 million a year. I think a good leader helps to define their own success. And I don't mean they're thinking about legacy within 5 minutes of joining the company. I think they're taking their organization on a journey and they're saying, we are going to achieve this, whatever that may be. The problem with the way some leaders are remunerated is total shareholder return, share price movement is quite often something that's totally out with their control. And also things they might do in their 3 to 5 years in charge, they plant seeds for the legacy, but you don't really know how well the organization is fared until maybe 5 years, 3 years after they've gone.
You boil the brief of leading down to three basic elements. Purpose, meaning does this person stand for something? Authenticity, meaning are they credible? and delivery, meaning will they achieve their goal? And it seems to me that the former two relate to how a person presents themselves. And only the third is a matter of cold hard record. How can we tell the leaders who will deliver before they're in a position to? I'm thinking of politicians specifically. How do we as a voting public interview them for the position in order to get clear hints of whether they possess the third quality, the quality of delivery?
The way to get picked for a CEO role, the way to get elected, I think you have to be, I hate these words like, you know, authenticity and passion and so on, but you have to be believable. You have to be able to talk in an everyday language, set out your stall, set out, you know, what could go right, what could go wrong. It has to be something that's seemingly achievable. I think if you are a politician on the stump promising trillions of pounds of investment or you know, moonshot schemes, I think you need to bring it back to what's actually achievable in the day to day.
Which only serves to deepen the mystery of Sven-Göran Eriksson, I think, who seemed to possess zero passion and conviction when he talked about the job.
Well, my wife is Swedish, and she so she had some, not much awareness of him before he got the England job. But I think she was as mystified as anyone. The whole of Sweden was mystified he got that job.
You also often talk about a leader's engine. Now, Thatcher is famously fabled to have only slept 4 or 5 hours a night. Johnson reportedly loses concentration when presented with a brief that's more than a side of A4. Is there a rather undervalued physical quality to leadership, the ability to operate at high capacity for long periods? Is that something that we overlook in favor of slightly less tangible qualities?
When I've done a lot of these interviews, you have what you call the furniture on the page. So if you look at something like the Sunday Times section, you will always have working day and downtime. So there's a real fascination in how these wonderfully successful people do it on a day-to-day basis. So that's why you have these working day boxes that say things like, woke up at 5:30, checked my emails from Asia, went to the gym for 2 hours, had breakfast, and then I had meetings every 15 minutes until midnight, or something crazy like that. But I think actually there is, I think this comes back to self-awareness. If you are, it could be totally overwhelming to wake up every morning and think, you know, I run this company, there are 300,000 people, we have revenues and operations in every country in the world and so on. So I think how they use their time is really, really interesting and worth studying. And the CEOs I've interviewed, and they said, look, I don't really have time to read books, but I do have people that read them for me.
A lot of these people appear slightly superhuman. And, you know, having interviewed them for many years, I don't know how much of that is a mystique that they cultivate or how much of it is genuinely true. I mean, do they get up at 4 o'clock and get on the treadmill and then, you know, go all the way through to 1 o'clock so they can look at the markets in Asia? Or is there a certain amount of myth building?
I think the successors today can't bank on the myth, can't bank on the mysticism. They have to be much more human than superhuman. That said, I think there are all flavors. I think there are those CEOs who have a quite light touch and probably don't put a huge number of hours in and trust their team and don't try to be everywhere and don't try to be across the details. But I think you also have, there's so many instances in the CEOs I've interviewed, it's not that where they are, they're expert sports people. So, you know, Tim Davey, now DG at the BBC, has run one of these awful multi-marathons across the African desert. And you've got competitive swimmers and so on. And actually, in the first chapter, I go back to how do these CEOs get where they are? And there are instances where the big talent factories, if you call them this, say a McKinsey or a Goldman Sachs or a Procter & Gamble, they do look at people who have academic excellence, but they're also looking for something else. They're looking for hinterland, and they're looking for competitive streaks. So that's why people who have taken up a sport and pursued it to some degree are easy hires for some of these organizations. So I think that's fascinating. And if you've done that when you're teens, you just carry on swimming or running right through, and it does become part of the routine.
Now, there have been various studies on the incidence of mental disorder in positions of leadership. Several, there was a big one done by a Canadian, but there was a recent one for the APS that found that up to 21% of managers had clinically significant psychopathy, compared to 1% in the general population. And this is something we see replicated again and again. Does that tally with your experience? Is there a touch of the mania to these people?
Mania, I wonder. I don't know how, if this strays into, I mean, it's difficult to call dedication mania. And your managers, is that mid-tier, do you think, or more at the top end you're talking about?
It was high tier they were looking at, and it was basically they were examining whether, you know, the qualities of you know, being unconcerned about the feelings of those around you, being able to dissemble easily, being able, you know, being cutthroat in many ways, were qualities which institutionally organizations tend to promote. And that's why you end up with a higher incidence, I would say, of damaged individuals on the top.
I think that could be where it has been. That could be something for leadership in years gone by. I wonder now whether we have had corporations that are very insular. It's been all about beating the competition and winning market share and so on. I think the pandemic has emphasized this. Companies don't exist in a vacuum. There has been this underscoring of social contract, if you like, that companies you'd have to work within their communities, with their suppliers and with governments. And many of them have been saved by governments over the last 12 months. So I think companies are a lot more porous than they've ever been. We're living in what I would call the glass door era. Someone who's sat inside an organization can very easily have a conversation and publicize a point with someone outside the organization. So I think hopefully that dissipates some of the mania.
Now, what sort of leader, finally, are you in your own life, in your own professional life? What have you looked at from your manual and thought, yes, that's how this works?
Well, I do feel with a book out, I'm a full-time seller at the moment, which is a totally new phenomenon, Alex, because I'm, as you know from reading...
Uncomfortable, is it?
Well, thank you for reading, but you know I've been used to asking the questions for many years, so it's a new thing
to be
answering them.
I found the portions of your book where you say how you prepared for an interview as interesting as the bits about leadership, I have to be honest. I found them very, very instructive for someone who is inexperienced in the interviewing game, as it were.
Well, I think it feels like you've done your homework today, so thank you. So I would say I've been a bit of a seller, and I suppose because I'm self-employed, I feel like I have to be quite a diplomat in the home. We all have to get on at the moment, so maybe my wife would give a different answer, but I think I'm part seller, part diplomat.
She'll probably go, he's an alpha. James Ashton, thank you for your time and for your clear-eyed contribution.
Thank you so much.
James Ashton's book, The Nine Types of Leader, is out on paperback now. And listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday mornings. You'll start the week supplement on Mondays and a longer weekly episode featuring a full panel every Tuesday. So don't forget to subscribe, review and rate us. Leadership, it is said, is like the sun shining on a meadow. Provided the elements are in the right place and a balance maintained, all the sun has to do is give generously, and in return, everything will naturally grow in its direction. In these times of long darkness and strangling weeds, this is vital to remember. This is Alex Andreu in the bunker saying over and out.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. An audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.